Hello, hello. Welcome back to another section of A Gentleman in Moscow by Omar Towles. If you are not a new subscriber or just watcher of this channel, you'll notice that I am back in my old filming location in Minnesota. I'm home for the holidays, so I will have this as my little nook for a few recordings here. I'm just gonna try to dive in and get through as much as we can with these recordings. They might end up being kind of long, but I think then we can like get through more and actually finish it up before the new year. Anyway, we are on page 237. And yeah, give me a thumb if you like it and comment books you want in the new year. You know, I'm trying to figure out what I'm gonna do. But anyway, page 237, let's jump in with adjustments. Never had the toll of a bell been so welcome. Not in Moscow, not in Europe, not in all the world. When the Frenchman Carpentier faced the American Dempsey, he could not have felt more relief upon hearing the clang that signaled the end of the third round than the Count felt upon hearing his own clock strike 12. Nor could the citizens of Prague, upon hearing the church bells that signaled the end of their siege at the hands of Frederick the Great. What was it about this child that prompted a grown man to count so carefully the minutes until lunch? Did she prattle on nonsensically? Did she flit about giggling? Did she dissolve into tears or launch into tantrums at the slightest provocation? On the contrary, she was quiet, unsettlingly so. Upon waking, she rose, dressed, and made her bed without a word. When the Count served breakfast, she nibbled her biscuits like a Trappist. Then, having quietly cleared her plate, she climbed up onto the Count's desk chair, sat on her hands, and gazed at him in silence. And what a gaze it was! With irises as dark and foreboding as the deep, it was positively unnerving. Without shyness or impatience, it seemed simply to say, "What now, Uncle Alexander?" "What now, indeed?" For having made their beds and nibbled their biscuits, the two of them had the whole day before them. 16 hours, 960 minutes, 57,600 seconds. The notion was indisputably daunting. But who was Alexander Rostov if not a seasoned conversationalist? At weddings and name day celebrations from Moscow to St. Petersburg, he had inevitably been seated beside the most recalcitrant of dinner guests, the prudish aunts and pompous uncles, the mirthless mordant and shy. Why? Because Alexander Rostov could be counted upon to draw his dinner companions into a lively conversation, whatever their dispositions. If he had happened to be seated beside Sophia at a dinner party, or for that matter, in the compartment of a train traveling across the countryside, what would he do? Naturally, he would ask her about her life. "Where are you from, my friend? Ivanovo, you say? I've never been, but always wanted to go. What is the best season to visit, and what should one see whilst one is there?" "So, tell me," the Count began with a smile, as Sophia's eyes opened wide. But even as the words were leaving his lips, the Count was having second thoughts, for he was decidedly not seated beside Sophia at a dinner party or in a railway car. She was a child who, with little explanation, had been uprooted from her home. To pursue a line of inquiry about the sights and seasons of Ivanova or daily life with her parents was almost certain to raise a host of sad associations, spurring feelings of longing and loss. "So tell me," he said again, feeling the onset of dizziness as her eyes opened wider, but just in time he had a flash of inspiration. "What is your dolly's name?" "A sure step, that one," thought the Count, with an inward pat on the back.
"Dolly doesn't have a name."
"What's that? No name? But surely your doll must have a name." Sophia stared at the Count for a moment, then tilted her head like a raven.
"Why?"
"Why?" repeated the Count. "Why, so that she can be addressed, so that she can be invited for tea, called to from across the room, discussed in conversation when absent, and included in your prayers. That is, for all the very reasons that you benefit from having a name." As Sophia considered this, the Count leaned forward, ready to elaborate on the matter to the smallest detail. But nodding once, the girl said,
"I shall call her Dolly."
Then she looked to the Count with her big blue eyes as if to say, "Now that's decided. What next?" The Count leaned back in his chair and began to sort through his vast catalogue of casual questions, discarding one after the other. But as luck would have it, he noticed that Sophia's gaze had shifted almost furtively towards something behind him. Discreetly, the Count glanced back. The ebony elephant, he realized with a smile. Raised her entire life in a rural province, the child had probably never even imagined that such an animal existed. What sort of fantastical beast is that, she must be wondering. Is it mammal or reptile? Fact or fable? "Have you ever seen one of those before?" the Count asked, with a backward gesture and a smile. "An elephant?" she asked. "Or a lamb?" The Count coughed. "I meant an elephant." "Only in books," she admitted a little sadly. "Ah, well, it is a magnificent animal, a wonder of creation." Sophia's interest piqued. The Count launched into a description of the species, animating each of its characteristics with an illustrative flourish of the arms. "A native of the Dark Continent, the mature example can weigh over 10,000 pounds. Its legs are as thick as tree trunks, and it bathes itself by drawing water into its proboscis and spraying it into the air." "So you have seen one?" she interrupted brightly. "On the Dark Continent?" The Count fidgeted. "Not exactly on the Dark Continent."
"Then where?"
"In various books."
"Oh," said Sophia, bringing the topic to a close with the efficiency of the guillotine.
The Count considered for a moment what other sort of wonder might capture her imagination, but which he had actually seen in person. "Would you like to hear a story about a princess?" he suggested. Sophia sat upright. "The age of the nobility has given way to the age of the common man," she said with the pride of one who has recited her times tables correctly. "It was historically inevitable."
"Yes," said the Count, "so I've been told."
"Do you enjoy pictures?" he asked, picking up an illustrated guide to the Louvre that he had borrowed from the basement. "Here's a lifetime supply. While I wash up, why don't you delve in?" Sophia moved a little in order to set Dolly at her side and then accepted the book in a ready and determined manner. Retreating to the safety of the washroom, the Count took off his shirt, bathed his upper body, and lathered his cheeks, all the while muttering the principal riddle of the day. "She is no more than 30 pounds, no more than 3 feet tall. Her entire bag of belongings could fit in a single drawer. She rarely speaks unless spoken to, and her heart beats no louder than a bird's. So how is it possible that she takes up so much space?" Over the years, the Count had come to think of his rooms as rather ample. In the morning, they easily accommodated 20 squats and 20 stretches, a leisurely breakfast, and the reading of a novel in a tilted chair. In the evenings after work, they fostered flights of fancy, memories of travel, and meditations on history, all crowned by a good night's sleep. Yet somehow, this little visitor, with her kit bag and her rag doll, had altered every dimension of the room. She had simultaneously brought the ceiling downward, the floor upward, the walls inward, such that anywhere he hoped to move, she was already there. Having roused himself from a fitful night on the floor, when the Count was ready for his morning calisthenics, she was standing in the calisthenic spot. At breakfast, she ate more than her fair share of the strawberries. Then, when he was able to dip his second biscuit in his second cup of coffee, she was staring at it with such longing that he had no choice but to ask if she wanted it. And when, at last, he was ready to lean back in his chair with his book, she was already sitting in it, staring up at him expectantly. But having caught himself waving his shaving brush emphatically at his own reflection, the Count stopped cold. "Good God," he thought, "is it possible? Already? At the age of 48? Alexander Rostov, could it be that you have become settled in your ways?" As a young man, the Count would never have been inconvenienced by a fellow soul. He sought out congenial company the moment he awoke. When he had read in his chair, no interruption could be counted as a disturbance. In fact, he preferred to read with a little racket in the background, like the shouts of a vendor in the street or the scales of a piano in a neighboring apartment, or best of all, footsteps on the stair. Footsteps that, having quickly ascended 2 flights, would suddenly stop,
bang on his door and breathlessly explain that two friends and a coach and four were waiting at the curb. After all, isn't that why the pages of books are numbered? To facilitate the finding of one's place after a reasonable interruption? As to possessions, he hadn't cared a whit about them. He was the first to lend a book or an umbrella to an acquaintance, never mind that no acquaintance since Adam had returned a book or an umbrella. And routines? He had prided himself on never having one. He would breakfast at 10 a.m. one day and 2 p.m. the next. At his favorite restaurants, he had never ordered the same dish twice in a season. Rather, he traveled across their menus, like Mr. Livingstone traveled across Africa and Magellan the Seven Seas. No, at the age of 22, Count Alexander Rostov could not be inconvenienced, interrupted, or unsettled, for every unexpected appearance, comment, or turn of events had been welcomed like a burst of fireworks in a summer sky, as something to be marveled at and cheered. But, apparently, this was no longer the case. The unanticipated arrival of a 30-pound package had torn the veil from his eyes. Without his even noticing, without his acknowledgement, input, or permission, routine had established itself within his daily life. Apparently, he now ate his breakfast at an appointed hour. Apparently, he must sip his coffee and nibble his biscuits without interruption. He must read in a particular chair tilted at a particular angle with no more than the scuffing of a pigeon's feet to distract him. He must shave his right cheek, shave his left, and only then move on to the underside of his chin. To that end, the count now tilted back his head and raised his razor, but the change in the angle of his gaze revealed two fathomless eyes staring back at him from the reflection in the mirror. "Egads! I have finished looking at the pictures," she said. "Which ones?" "All of them." "All of them?" It was now the count's eyes that opened wide. "Well, isn't that splendid?"
"I think it is for you," she said, holding out a small envelope.
"Where did that come from?"
"It was slipped under your door."
Taking the envelope in hand, the count could tell that it was empty. But in place of an address, the query, 3 o'clock, was written in a willowy script. "Ah, yes," said the count, stuffing it in his pocket. "A small matter of business." Then he thanked Sophia in a manner indicating that she could now be on her way, and she replied, "You're welcome," in a manner indicating that she had no intention of going anywhere. Thus had the count leapt from his bed and clapped his hands at the first chime of the noon hour. "Right," he said, "how about some lunch? You must be famished. I think you will find the piazza positively delightful. More than simply a restaurant, the piazza was designed to be an extension of the city, of its gardens, markets, and thoroughfares." But as the count continued with his description of the piazza's advantages, he noticed that Sophia was staring at his father's clock with an expression of surprise, and when they passed over the threshold to go downstairs, she took another look back, then hesitated, as if on the verge of asking how such a delicate device could generate such a lovely sound. Well, thought the count as he began to close the door, if she wanted to know the secrets of the twice-tolling clock, she had to come to the right place, for not only did the count know something of chronometry, he knew absolutely everything there was to know about this particular...
"Uncle Alexander," Sophia said in the tender tone of one who must deliver unhappy news, "I fear your clock is broken."
Taken aback, the count released his grip on the doorknob. "Broken? No, no, I assure you, Sophia, my clock keeps perfect time. In fact, it was made by craftsmen known the world over for their commitment to precision."
"It isn't the timekeeper that is broken," she explained. "It is the chime."
"But it just chimed beautifully."
"Yes, it chimed at noon, but it failed to chime at 9 and 10 and 11.
"Ah," the count said with a smile, "normally you would be perfectly right, my dear, but you see, this is a twice-tolling clock. It was made many years ago to my father's specification to toll only twice a day."
"But why?"
"Why indeed, my friend, why indeed? I'll tell you what. Let us adjourn to the piazza, where, having placed our order and made ourselves comfortable, we shall investigate all the whys and wherefores of my father's clock. For there is nothing more essential to the enjoyment of a civilized lunch than to have a lively topic of conversation." At 12:10, the piazza was not yet bustling, but perhaps this was just as well, as the Count and Sophia received an excellent table and prompt attention from Martin, a capable new waiter who pulled back Sophia's chair with an admirable sense of politesse. My niece, explained the Count as Sophia looked around the room in amazement. I have a 6-year-old of my own, Martin replied with a smile. I'll give you a moment. Granted, Sophia was not so unworldly as to be unfamiliar with elephants, but she had never seen anything quite like the piazza. Not only was she marveling at the room's scale and elegance, but at each of the individual elements that seemed to turn common sense on its head, a ceiling made of glass, a tropical garden indoors, a fountain in the middle of a room. When Sophia completed her survey of the piazza's paradoxes, she seemed to understand instinctively that such a setting deserved an elevated standard of behavior, for she suddenly took her doll off the table and placed it on the empty chair to her right. When the Count slipped his napkin out from under his silverware to place it in his lap, Sophia followed suit, taking particular care not to jangle her fork and knife, and when having placed their order with Martin, the Count said, "Thank you so much, my good man." Sophia echoed the Count word for word. Then she looked to the Count expectantly. "Now?" she asked. "Now what, my dear?" "Is now when you will tell me about the twice-tolling clock?" "Oh, yes, precisely. But where to start?" "Naturally enough, at the beginning." The twice-tolling clock, the Count explained, had been commissioned by his father from the venerable firm of Bruguet, establishing their shop in Paris in 1775. The Bruguets were quickly known the world over, not only for the precision of their chronometers, that is, the accuracy of their clocks, but for the elaborate means by which their clocks could signal the passage of time. They had clocks that played a few measures of Mozart at the end of the hour. They had clocks that chimed not only at the hour, but at the half and the quarter. They had clocks that displayed the phases of the moon, the progress of the seasons, and the cycle of the tides. But when the Count's father visited their shop in 1882, he posed a very different sort of challenge for the firm, a clock that tolled only twice a day. "Why would he do so?" asked the Count, in anticipation of his young listener's favorite interrogative. Quite simply, the Count's father had believed that while a man should attend closely to life, he should not attend too closely to the clock. A student of both the Stoics and Montaigne, the Count's father believed that our Creator had set aside the morning hours for industry. That is, if a man woke no later than 6, engaged in a light repast, and then applied himself without interruption, by the hour of noon, he should have accomplished a full day's labor. Thus, in his father's view, the toll of 12 was a moment of reckoning. When the noon bell sounded, the diligent man could take pride in having made good use of the morning and sit down to his lunch with a clear conscience. But when it sounded for the frivolous man, the man who had squandered his morning in bed or on breakfast with 3 papers or on idle chatter in the sitting room, he had no choice but to ask for his lord's forgiveness. In the afternoon, the Count's father believed that a man should take care not to live by the watch in his waistcoat, marking the minutes as if the events of one's life were stations on a railway line. Rather, having been suitably industrious before lunch, he should spend his afternoon in wise liberty. That is, he should walk among the willows, read a timeless text, converse with a friend beneath the pergola, or reflect before the fire, engaging in those endeavors that have no appointed hour and that dictate their own beginnings and ends. And the second chime? The Count's father was of the mind that one should never hear it. If one had lived one's day well, in the service of industry, liberty, and the Lord, one should be soundly asleep long before 12. So the second chime of the twice-tolling clock was definitely a remonstrance. "What are you up to? Or what are you doing up?" it was meant to say. "Were you so profligate with your daylight that you must hunt about for things to do in the dark? Your veal." "Ah, thank you, Martin." Quite appropriately, Martin placed the first dish before Sophia and the second before the Count. Then he lingered a little closer to the table than was necessary. "Thank you," the Count said again in a polite sign of dismissal. But as the Count took up his silverware and began recalling for Sophia's benefit how he and his sister would sit by the twice-tolling clock on the last night of December in order to ring in the new year, Martin took a step even closer. "Yes?" asked the Count somewhat impatiently. Martin hesitated. "Shall I cut the young lady's meat. The Count looked across the table to where Sophia, fork in hand, was staring at her plate. Mon Dieu, thought the Count. No need, my friend, I shall see to it. As Martin backed away with a bow, the Count circled the table and in a few quick strokes had cut Sophia's veal into 8 pieces. Then, on the verge of setting down her cutlery, he cut the 8 pieces into 16. By the time he had returned to his seat, she had already eaten 4. Having regained her energy through sustenance, Sophia now unleashed a cavalcade of whys. Why was it better to commune with work in the morning and nature in the afternoon? Why would a man read 3 newspapers? Why should one walk under the willows rather than some other sort of tree? And what was a pergola? Which in turn led to additional inquiries regarding Eidelhauer, the Countess, and Helena. In principle, the Count generally regarded a barrage of interrogatives as bad form. Left to themselves, the words who, what, why, when, and where do not a conversation make. But as the Count began to answer Sophia's litany of queries, sketching the layout of Eidelhauer on the tablecloth with the tines of his fork, describing the personality of family members, and referencing various traditions, he noticed that Sophia was entirely, absolutely, and utterly engaged. What elephants and princesses had failed to accomplish, the life at Eidelhauer had apparently achieved. And just like that, her veal was gone. When the plates had been cleared away, Martin reappeared to inquire if they would be having dessert. The Count looked to Sophia with a smile, assuming that she would leap at the chance, but she bit her lower lip and shook her head. "Are you quite sure?" the Count asked. "Ice cream? Cookies? A piece of cake?" But shifting a bit in her chair, she shook her head again. "Entered the new generation," thought the Count with a shrug, while returning the dessert menu to Martin. "Apparently we are done." Martin accepted the menu, but once again lingered. Then, turning his back slightly to the table, he actually leaned over with the clear intention of whispering in the Count's ear. For goodness sake, thought the Count, what now? "Count Rostov, I believe that your niece may need to go." "Go? Go where?" Martin hesitated. "To the privy." The Count looked up at the waiter and then at Sophia. Say no more, Martin. The waiter bowed and excused himself. "Sophia," the Count suggested tentatively, "shall we visit the ladies' room?" Still biting her lip, Sophia nodded. "Do you need me to accompany you inside?" he asked after leading her down the hallway. Sophia shook her head and disappeared behind the washroom door. As he waited, the Count chastised himself for his lug-headedness. Not only had he failed to cut her meat and bring her to the ladies' room, he clearly hadn't thought to help her unpack, because she was wearing the exact same clothes she had worn the day before. "And you call yourself a waiter," he said to himself. A moment later, Sophia emerged looking relieved, but then, despite her readily apparent love of interrogatives, she hesitated like one who was struggling with whether to ask a question. "What is it, my dear? Is there something on your mind?" Sophia struggled for another moment, then worked up the nerve. "Can we still have dessert, Uncle Alexander?" Now it was the Count who looked relieved. "Without a doubt, my dear. Without a doubt." Page 248, Ascending, Alighting. At 2 o'clock, when Marina answered her office door to find the Count at the threshold in the company of a little girl with a rag doll gripped tightly by the neck, she was so surprised her eyes almost came into alignment. "Ah, Marina," said the Count, raising his eyebrows meaningfully, "you remember Nina Kolokova? May I present her daughter, Sophia? She will be staying with us in the hotel for a bit." As a mother of 2, Marina did not need the Count's signal to tell her that something weighty had occurred in the life of the child, but she could also see that the girl was curious about the whirring sound coming from the other end of the room. "What a pleasure to meet you, Sophia," she said. "I knew your mother well when she was just a few years older than you are now. But tell me, have you ever seen a sewing machine?" Sophia shook her head. "Well then, come and let me show you one." Offering Sophia her hand, Marina led the girl to the other side of the room where her assistant was mending a royal blue drape. Dropping down so that she would be at Sophia's level, Marina pointed to various parts of the machine and explained their use. Then asking the young seamstress to show Sophia their collection of fabrics and buttons, she came back to the count with an expression of inquiry. In a hushed voice, he quickly recounted the events of the previous day. "You can see the predicament I'm in," concluded the count. "I can see the predicament that Sophia is in," corrected Marina. "Yes, you're absolutely right," the count admitted contritely. Then, just as he was about to continue, he had a notion so inspired it was incredible. He hadn't thought of it before. "I came, Marina, to see if you'd be willing to watch Sophia for an hour while I am at the Boyarsky's daily meeting." "Of course I will," said Marina. "As I say, I came with that intention, but as you have so rightly pointed out, it is Sophia who deserves our support and consideration, and watching you together just now, seeing your instinctive tenderness and seeing the way that she felt instantly at ease in your company, it was suddenly so obvious that what she needs, especially at this juncture in her life, is a mother's touch, a mother's way, a mother's..." But Marina cut him off, and from the bottom of her heart, she said, "Do not ask that of me, Alexander Ilyich. Ask it of yourself." "I can do this," said the count to himself as he skipped up the stairs to the Boyarsky. After all, it was really just a matter of making some minor adjustments, a rearranging of some furniture and a shifting of some habits. Since Sophia was too young to be left alone, he would eventually need to find someone who could sit with her while he was at work. For tonight, he would simply request an evening off, suggesting that his tables be divided between Dennis and Dmitri. But in an extraordinary example of a friend anticipating the needs of a friend, when the count arrived at the meeting of the Triumvirate a few minutes late, Andrew said, "There you are, Alexander. Emil and I were just discussing that Dennis and Dmitri can share your tables tonight." Collapsing into his chair, the count let out a sigh of relief. "Perfect," he said. "By tomorrow, I shall come up with a longer-term solution." The chef and maitre d' looked at the count in confusion. "A longer-term solution? Weren't you splitting my tables so that I could be free for the evening?" "Free for the evening?" gasped Andri. Emil guffawed. "Alexander, my friend, it is the third Saturday of the month. You'll be expected in the yellow room at 10. "Mein Gott," thought the count. He had completely forgotten. What's more, the GAZ dinner is in the red room at 7:30. The director of Gorkovsky Avtomobilny Zavod, the state's leading automotive manufacturing agency, was hosting a formal dinner to commemorate their 5th anniversary. In addition to key staff members, the event was to be attended by the Commissar of Heavy Industry and 3 representatives of the Ford Motor Company, who didn't speak a word of Russian. "I shall see to it personally," said the count. "Good," said the maitre d'. "Dmitri has already set up the room." Then he slid 2 envelopes across the table to the count. In accordance with Bolshevik custom, the tables in the red room had been laid out in the shape of a long U with chairs arranged on the outer perimeter, such that all the men seated could watch the head of the table without craning their necks. Satisfied that the settings were in order, the count turned his attention to the envelopes that Andrew had given him. Unsealing the smaller of the two, he removed the seating chart, which had presumably been prepared in some office in the Kremlin. Then he opened the larger envelope, spilled out the place cards, and began positioning them accordingly. Having circled the table a second time in order to double-check the precision of his own execution, the count stuffed the 2 envelopes into the pockets of his pants, only to discover another envelope. Removing the 3rd envelope, the count considered it with a furrowed brow. That is, until he turned it over and saw the willowy script. Great Scott! According to the clock on the wall, it was already 3:15. The count dashed out of the red room, down the hall, and up a flight of stairs. Finding the door to suite 311 ajar, he slipped inside, closed the door, and crossed the grand salon. In the bedroom, a silhouette turned from the window as her dress fell to the floor with a delicate whoosh. The count replied with a slight cough. "Anna, my love, Noting the expression on the Count's face, the actress pulled her dress back up toward her shoulders. I'm terribly sorry, but due to a confluence of unexpected events, I am not going to be able to keep our appointment today. In fact, for related reasons, I may need to ask a small favor. In the 15 years that they had known each other, the Count had only asked Anna for one favor, and that had weighed less than 2 ounces. Of course, Alexander, she replied. What is it? How many suitcases do you travel with? A few minutes later, the Count was hurrying down the staff stairwell, 2 Parisian traveling cases in hand. With new respect, he thought of Grisha and Genya and all their predecessors. For though Anna's cases had been fashioned from the finest materials, they seemed to have been designed without the slightest consideration for having to be carried. The little leather handles were so small one could barely slip 2 fingers through them, and the case's dimensions were so generous that at every step they banged from the banister to one's knee. How could the bellhops possibly manage to carry these things around so effortlessly, and often with a hat box thrown in for good measure? Arriving at the subfloor, the Count pushed his way through the staff doors into the laundry. In the first suitcase, he stowed 2 sheets, a bed cover, and a towel. In the second, he packed a pair of pillows. Then back up 6 flights he went, banging his knees at every turn of the belfry stairs. In his room, he unloaded the linens and then went down the hall to get a set mattress from one of the abandoned rooms. This had seemed an excellent idea to the Count when it had struck him, but the mattress was decidedly against it. When he bent over to lift the mattress from the bed springs, it crossed its arms, held its breath, and refused to budge. When he managed to get it upright, it immediately flopped over his head, nearly knocking him off his feet. And when he'd finally dragged it down the hall and flumped it in his room, it spread out its limbs, claiming every spare inch of the floor. This will not do, thought the Count with his hands on his hips. If he left the mattress there, how were they to move about? And he certainly wasn't going to drag it in and out of the room on a daily basis. But in a flash of inspiration, the Count was reminded that morning, 16 years ago, when he had consoled himself that living in this room would provide the satisfactions of traveling by train. Yes, he thought, that is it exactly. Lifting the mattress onto its edge, he leaned it against the wall and warned it to stay put if it knew what was good for it. Then he took Anna's suitcases and ran down 4 flights to the pantry of the Boyarsky, where the canned tomatoes were stored. With an approximate height of 8 inches and a diameter of 6, they were perfectly suited to the task. So, having lugged them back upstairs with a healthy measure of huffing and puffing, he stacked, hoisted, pulled, and perched upon until the room was ready. Then, having returned Anna's cases, he dashed down the stairs. When the Count arrived at Marina's office, more than an hour late, he was relieved to find the seamstress and Sophia seated on the floor in close consultation. Bounding up, Sophia held out her doll, which was now in a royal blue dress with little black buttons down the front. Do you see what we have made for Dolly, Uncle Alexander? How lovely. She's quite a seamstress, said Marina. Sophia hugged Marina and then skipped into the hall with her newly attired companion. The Count began to follow his charge, but Marina called him back. Alexander, what arrangements have you made for Sophia while you were at work tonight? The Count bit his lip. All right, she said. I will stay with her this evening, but tomorrow you will need to find someone else. You should speak with one of the younger chambermaids, perhaps Natasha. She is unmarried and would be good with children, but you have to pay her a reasonable wage. Natasha, confirmed the Count with gratitude. I'll speak to her first thing tomorrow, and a reasonable wage, absolutely. Thank you so much, Marina. I'll send you and Sophia dinner from the Boyarsky around 7, and if last night is any indication, she will be sound asleep by 9. The Count turned to go, then turned back again. And I'm sorry about earlier. It's all right, Alexander. You were anxious because you haven't spent time with children before, but I am certain that you are up to the challenge. If you are ever in doubt, just remember that, unlike adults, children want to be happy, so they still have the ability to take the greatest pleasure in the simplest things. By way of example, the seamstress placed something small and seemingly insignificant in the Count's hand with an assurance and a few words of instruction. As a result, when the Count and Sophia had climbed the 5 flights back up to their rooms, and she had turned her deep blue gaze of expectation upon him, the count was ready. "Would you like to play a game?" he asked. "I would," she said. "Then come this way." With a touch of ceremony, the count ushered Sophia through the closet door into the study. "Ooh," she said as she emerged on the other side. "Is this your secret room?" "It is our secret room," the count replied. Sophia nodded gravely to show that she understood. But then children understand the purpose of secret rooms better than they understand the purpose of congresses, courtrooms, and banks. Somewhat shyly, Sophia pointed at the painting. "Is that your sister?"
"Yes, Helena."
"I like peaches too." She ran a hand along the coffee table. "Is this where your grandma had tea?"
"Exactly."
Sophia nodded gravely again. "I am ready for the game."
"All right then, here's how we play. You will go back into this bedroom and count to 200. I shall remain in order to hide this within the boundaries of the study." Then, as if from thin air, the count produced the silver thimble that Marina had given him. "Sophia, do you know how to count to 200?
"No," she admitted, "but I can count to 100 twice."
"Well done."
Sophia exited through the closet, pulling the door shut behind her. The count glanced about the room in search of an appropriate spot, one that would prove reasonably challenging for the child without taking unfair advantage of her age. After a few minutes of consideration, he approached the little bookcase and carefully placed the thimble on top of Anna Karenina. Then he took a seat. At the count of 200, the closet door opened a crack. "Are you ready?" she asked.
"Indeed, I am."
When Sophia came in, the count expected her to scamper about the room willy-nilly, looking every which way. Instead, she remained in the doorway, quietly, almost unsettlingly, studied the room from quadrant to quadrant, upper left, lower left, upper right, lower right. Then, without a word, she walked straight to the bookcase and picked the thimble up off the top of the Tolstoy. This had occurred in less time than it would have taken for the count to count to 100. Once. "Well done," said the count, not meaning it. "Let's play again." Sophia handed the count the thimble, but as soon as she left the room, the count chastised himself for not having considered his next hiding place before initiating the second round. Now he had only 200 seconds to find a suitable spot. As if to unnerve him further, Sophia began counting so loudly that he could hear her through the closed closet door. 21, 22, 23. Suddenly, it was the count who was scampering about willy-nilly and looking every which way, discarding this spot for being too easy and that spot for being too hard. In the end, he tucked the thimble under the handle of the ambassador on the other side of the room from the bookcase. When Sophia returned, she followed the same procedure as before. Although, as if anticipating the count's petty little trick, this time she began her survey in the corner opposite from where she had found the thimble the first round. It took her all of 20 seconds to pluck it from its hiding place. Clearly, the count had underestimated his adversary, but by placing the thimble in such low locations, he had been playing to Sophia's natural strengths. In the next round, he would take advantage of her limitations by hiding it 6 or 7 feet off the ground. "Again," he said with the smile of a fox, "it's your turn."
"What's that?"
"It is your turn to look, and my turn to hide."
"No, you see, in this game, I always do the hiding, and you always do the hunting."
Sophia studied the count as her mother would have. "If you always do the hiding, and I always do the hunting, then it wouldn't be a game at all." The count frowned at the indisputability of this point of view, and when she held out her hand, he dutifully placed the thimble in her palm. As if this turnabout weren't enough, when he reached for the doorknob, she tugged at his sleeve. "Uncle Alexander, you won't peek, will you?"
"Won't peek?"
The count had a mind to say a word or two about the integrity of the Rostovs. Instead, he composed himself. "No, Sophia, I will not peek."
"You promise?"
"I promise." The count went out into the bedroom, muttering something about his word being his bond and never having cheated at cards or welched on a wager, and then he began to count. As he proceeded past 150, he could hear Sophia moving around the study, and when he reached 175, he heard a chair being pushed across the floor. Well aware of the difference that a gentleman and a cad, the count counted until the room fell silent. That is, all the way to 222. "Ready or not?" he called. When he came into the room, Sophia was sitting in one of the high back chairs. With a bit of theatricality, the Count put his hands behind his back and circled the room while saying, But after two circuits, the little silver thimble had yet to reveal itself, so began to search a bit more in earnest. Taking a page from Sophia's book, he divided the room into quadrants and reviewed them systematically, but to no avail. Recalling that he had heard one of the chairs being moved and accounting for Sophia's height and arm extension, the Count estimated that she could have reached a spot less than 5 feet off the ground. So he looked behind the frame of his sister's portrait, he looked under the mechanics of the little window, he even looked above the doorframe. Still, no thimble. Occasionally, he would look back at Sophia in the hopes that she would give herself away by glancing at her hiding place, but she maintained an infuriatingly disinterested expression as if she had the slightest awareness of the hunt that was underway, and all the while swinging her little feet back and forth. As a student of psychology, the Count decided he must attempt to solve the problem from his opponent's point of view. Just as he had wanted to take advantage of her limited height, perhaps she had taken advantage of his stature. Of course, he thought. The sound of moving furniture didn't have to mean that she was climbing up on a chair. It could have been her pulling something aside in order to hide something beneath it. The Count dropped to the floor and crawled like a lizard from the bookcase to the ambassador and back again. And still she sat there, swinging her little feet. The Count stood to his full height, banging his head against the slope of the ceiling. What's more, his kneecaps hurt from the hardwood floor and his jacket was covered in dust. Suddenly, as he looked a little wildly around the room, he became aware of a quietly encroaching eventuality. It was slinking slowly toward him like a cat across the lawn, and the name of this cat was Defeat. Could it be? Was he, a Rostov, prepared to surrender? Well, in a word, yes. There were no two ways about it. He had been bested and he knew it. Naturally, there would have to be a word or two of self-recrimination, but first he cursed Marina and the alleged pleasures of simple games. He breathed deeply and exhaled. Then he presented himself to Sophia as General Mack had presented himself to Napoleon, having let the Russian army slip through his grasp. "Well done, Sophia," he said. Sophia looked directly at the Count for the first time since he'd come into the room. "Are you giving up?" "I am conceding," said the Count. "Is that the same as giving up?" "Yes, it is the same as giving up." "Then you should say so." Naturally, his humiliation must be brought to its full realization. "I give up," he said. Without a hint of gloating, Sophia accepted his surrender, then she jumped off her chair and walked toward him. He stepped a little out of her way, assuming that she must have hid the thimble somewhere in the bookcase. But she didn't approach the bookcase. Instead, she stopped in front of him, reached into his jacket pocket, and withdrew the thimble. The Count was aghast. In fact, he actually sputtered. But Sophia, that's not fair. Sophia studied the Count with curiosity. "Why is it not fair?" "Always with that damnable why." "Because it's not," replied the Count. "But you said we could hide it anywhere in the room." "That's just it, Sophia. My pocket wasn't in the room." "Your pocket was in the room when I hid the thimble, and it was in the room when you hunted." And as the Count gazed into her innocent little face, it all became clear. He, master of nuance and sleight of hand, had been played at every turn. When she had called him back to insist he not peek and had so sweetly tugged at his sleeve, that was a ploy to mask the slipping of the thimble into his pocket. And the moving of the furniture as the 200th second approached, pure theater. A ruthless case of dissembling. And even as he searched, there she sat, clutching her little dolly in its bright blue dress, without ever once betraying her wiles. The Count took one step back and bowed at the waist. page 258 with the star. At 6 o'clock, having descended to the ground floor to deliver Sophia into Marina's care, returned up to the sixth floor to retrieve Sophia's doll, and then down to the ground floor to deliver it, the Count proceeded to the Boyarsky. Apologizing to Andrew for being late, he quickly assessed his team, reviewed the tables, adjusted the glasses, aligned silver, took a peek at Emil, and finally gave the signal that the restaurant could be opened. At 7:30, he went to the Red Room to oversee the GAZ dinner. Then at 10, he headed down the hall to where the doors of the Yellow Room were being guarded by a Goliath. Ever since 1930, the Count and Osip had been dining together on the third Saturday of the month in order to further the former Red Army colonel's understanding of the West. Dedicated the first several years to a study of the French, covering their idioms and forms of address, the personalities of Napoleon, Richelieu, and Talleyrand, the essence of the Enlightenment, the genius of Impressionism, and the prevailing attitude for je ne sais quoi, the Count and Osip spent the next few years studying the British, covering the necessity of tea, the implausible rules of cricket, the etiquette of fox hunting, their relentless, if well-deserved, pride in Shakespeare, and the all-encompassing, overriding importance of the pub. But more recently, they had shifted their attention to the United States. To that end, tonight on the table beside their neatly empty plates were two copies of Alexis de Tocqueville's masterpiece, Democracy in America. Osip had been somewhat intimidated by its length, but the Count had assured him that there was no better text with which to establish a fundamental understanding of American culture. So the former colonel had burned the midnight oil for 3 weeks and arrived in the Yellow Room with the eagerness of a well-prepared schoolboy at his baccalaureate. And having seconded the Count's fondness for summer nights, echoed his compliments on the sauce au poivre, and shared his appreciation of the claret's nose, Osip was itching to get down to business. "It is indeed a lovely wine, a lovely steak, and a lovely summer night," he said, "but shouldn't we be shifting our attention to the book?" "Yes, certainly," said the Count, setting down his glass. "Let us turn our attention to the book. Why don't you start us off?" "Well, first, I'd have to say that it is no call of the wind." "No," said the Count with a smile, "it is certainly no call of the wind. And I have to admit that while I appreciate de Tocqueville's attention to detail, on the whole, I found the first volume on the American's political system rather slow in going." "Yes," the Count nodded sagely, "the first volume may well be characterized as detailed to a fault. But the second volume, on the characteristics of their society, I found to be absolutely fascinating." "In that, you are not alone. In fact, right from the first line..." "Wait, where is it? Here we are. There is not, I think, a single country in the civilized world where less attention is paid to philosophy than in the United States." "Ha! That should tell us a thing or two." "Quite so," said the Count with a chuckle. "And here, a few chapters later, he singles out their unusual passion for material well-being. The minds of Americans, he says, are universally preoccupied with meeting the body's every need and attending to life's little comforts. And that was in 1840. Imagine if we had visited them in the 1920s. "Ha! Visited them in the 1920s. Well put, my friend. But tell me, Alexander, what are we to make of his assertion that democracy is particularly suited to industry?" The Count leaned back in his chair and moved about his utensils. "Yes, the question of industry. That is an excellent place to dig in, Osip. Right at the heart of it. What do you make of it?" "But I was asking what you made of it, Alexander." "And you shall hear what I think without fail, but as your tutor, I would be remiss were I to skew your impressions before you had the chance to formulate them yourself. So let us begin with the freshness of your thoughts." Osip studied the Count, who in turn reached for his glass of wine. "Alexander, you have read the book." "Of course I have read the book," confirmed the Count, putting down his glass. "I mean, you have read both volumes to the very last page." "Osip, my friend, it is a fundamental rule of academic study that whether a student has read every word of a work matters less than whether he has established a reasonable familiarity with this essential material." And to which page does your reasonable familiarity extend in this particular work?
Ahem, said the Count, opening to the table of contents. Let me see now. Yes, yes, yes. He looked up at Osip.
87?
Osip considered the Count for a moment. Then he picked up de Tocqueville and hurled him across the room. The French historian crashed headfirst into a framed photograph of Lenin leaning over a podium, shattering the glass and falling to the floor with a thud. The door to the yellow room flew open and the Goliath, leapt inside with his firearm drawn.
Gadzooks! Exclaimed the Count, raising his hands above his head.
Osip, on the verge of commanding his bodyguard to shoot his tutor, took a deep breath, then simply shook his head.
It's all right, Vladimir.
Vladimir nodded once and returned to his station in the hall. Osip folded his hands on the table and looked at the Count, waiting for an explanation.
I am so sorry, the Count said in genuine embarrassment. I meant to finish it, Osip. In fact, I had cleared my calendar today in order to read the rest when circumstances intervened.
Circumstances.
Unexpected circumstances.
What sort of unexpected circumstances?
A young lady.
A young lady?
The daughter of an old friend. She appeared out of the blue and will be staying with me for a spell.
Osip looked at the Count as if dumbfounded, then let out a laugh.
Well, 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 Alexander Ilyich, a young lady staying with you. Why didn't you say so? You are utterly absolved, you old fox, or at least mostly so. We shall have our de Tocqueville, mind you, and you shall read every last page, but for now. Don't let me keep you another second. It's not too late for some caviar in the Shilopin.
Then you can whisk her to the piazza for a little dancing.
Actually, she is a very young lady.
How young a lady?
5 or 6.
5 or 6?
I'd say almost certainly 6.
You're hosting an almost certainly 6-year-old.
Yes, in your room.
Precisely.
For how long?
A few weeks, maybe a month, but no more than 2.
Osip smiled and nodded his head.
I see.
To be perfectly honest, the Count admitted, so far her visit has been a little disruptive to the daily routine, but that's to be expected, I suppose, given that she has only just arrived. Once we've made some minor adjustments and she has had a chance to acclimatize, then everything should go back to running without a hitch.
Without a doubt, agreed Osip.
In the meantime, don't let me keep you.
Promising to read his de Tocqueville by their very next meeting, the Count excused himself and slipped out the door while Osip picked up the claret.
Finding the bottle empty, he reached across the table for the Count's unfinished glass and poured it into his.
Did he remember those days when his children were almost certainly 6?
When there was a pitter-pat in the hallways an hour before dawn? When every object smaller than an apple was nowhere to be found until it was right underfoot? When books went unread, letters unanswered, and every train of thought was left incomplete? He remembered them as if they were yesterday.
Without a doubt, he said again, with a smile on his face,
once they have made some minor adjustments, everything should go back to running without a hitch.
The Count was generally of a mind that grown men should not run in hallways, but when he left Osip it was nearly 11, and he had already taken ample advantage of Marina's good nature. So making an exception just this once, he sprinted down the hall, around the corner, and ran smack into some fellow with a ragged beard who was pacing at the top of the stairs.
Mishka! Ah, there you are, Sasha!
The instant the Count recognized his old friend, his first thought was that he would have to send him on his way. But also see to do, there was no two ways about it. But when he got a good look at Mishka's face, he could tell that this was impossible. Something of significance had clearly occurred. So instead of sending him on his way, the Count led him back up to his study, where, having taken a seat, Mishka turned his hat in his hands.
"Weren't you scheduled to arrive in Moscow tomorrow?" the Count ventured after a brief silence.
"Yes," said Mishka, with a careless wave of his hat, "but I came a day early at the Shalomov's request. An acquaintance from their university days, Viktor Shalomov, was now the senior editor at Gozlitizat. It was his idea to have Mishka edit their forthcoming volumes of Anton Chekhov's collected letters,
a project that Mishka had been slaving over since 1934.
Ah, said the Count brightly, you must be nearly done.
Nearly done, Mishka repeated with a laugh. You are quite right, Sasha. I am nearly done. In fact, all that remains is to remove a word. Here is what had unfolded.
Early that morning, Mikhail Mindich had arrived in Moscow on the overnight train from Leningrad. With the galleys on their way to the printer, Shalimov had said he wanted to take Mishka to the Central House of Writers for a celebratory lunch. But when Mishka had arrived in the publisher's reception room shortly before 1 o'clock, Shalimov asked him to come back to his office. Once they were settled, Shalimov congratulated Mishka on a job well done. Then he patted the galleys that, as it turned out, were not on their way to the printer, but were lying right there on the editor's desk. Yes, it was a job of nuance and erudition, Shalimov said, a paragon of scholarship. But there was one small matter that needed to be addressed before printing. It was an elision of the letter of the 6th of June, 1904. Mishka knew the letter well. It was the bittersweet missive written by Chekhov to his sister Maria, in which he presents his full recovery just a few weeks before his death. During typesetting, a word must have been dropped, which just shows that no matter how many times you review a galley, you will never catch every flaw.
Let's see to it, said Mishka. Here, said the Shalimov, rotating the galley so that Mishka could review the letter for himself.
Berlin, June 6th, 1904. Dear Masha, I am writing you from Berlin. I have been here a whole day now. It turned very cold in Moscow and even snowed after you left. The bad weather must have given me a cold. I began having rheumatic pains in my arms and legs. I couldn't sleep at night. Lost a great deal of weight, had morphine injections, took thousands of different kinds of medicine, and recall with gratitude only the heroin Altschuler once prescribed for me. Nonetheless, toward departure time, I began to recover my strength. My appetite returned, I began giving myself arsenic injections, and so on and so forth, and finally, on Thursday, I left the country very thin and very thin, with very thin, emaciated legs. I had a fine, pleasant trip. Here in Berlin, we've taken a comfortable room in the best hotel. I'm very much enjoying the life here and haven't eaten so well and with such an appetite in a long time. The bread here is amazing. I've been stuffing myself with it. The coffee is excellent, and the dinners are beyond words. People who have never been abroad don't know how good bread can be. There is no decent tea. We have our own kind, and none of our hors d'oeuvres, but everything else is superb, and even though it's cheaper here than in Russia, I've already put on weight. And today, despite the chill in the air, I even took the long ride to the Tiergarten. And so you can tell Mother and anyone else who's interested that I'm on my way to recovery, or even that I've already recovered, etc., etc. Yours, A. Chekhov. Mishka read the passage once, then read it again, while calling up in his mind's eye an image of the original letter. After 4 years, he knew most of them by heart, but as hard as he tried, he could not identify the discrepancy.
What is missing? He asked at last.
Oh, said Shalimov, in the tone of one who suddenly understands a simple misapprehension between friends. It is not that something is missing. It is that something must be taken out. Here. Shalimov reached across the desk in order to point to the lines in which Chekhov had shared his first impressions of Berlin, but particularly his praise for their amazing bread, and his observations that Russians who hadn't traveled had no idea how good bread could be.
This part should be taken out?
Yes, that's right.
As in stricken.
If you wish.
And why, might I ask?
In the interests of concision.
So it is to save paper.
And once I have taken out this little passage of the 6th of June, where shall you have me put it? In the bank? In a dresser drawer? In Lenin's tomb? As Mishka had been relating this exchange to the Count, his voice had grown increasingly loud, as if with a renewed sense of outrage. But then he suddenly fell silent. And then Shalimov, he continued after a moment, this Shalimov from our youth, he tells me
that I can shoot the passage from a cannon for all he cares, but it must be taken out. So do you know what I did, Sasha? Can you even imagine? One might well draw the conclusion that a man prone to pacing is a man who will act judiciously, given the unusual amount of time he has allocated to the consideration of causes and consequences, of ramifications and repercussions. It had been the Count's experience that men prone to pace are always on the verge of acting impulsively. For while the men who pace are being whipped along by logic, it is a multifaceted sort of logic, which brings them no closer to a clear understanding or even a state of conviction. Rather, it leaves them at such a loss that they end up exposed to the influence of the merest whim, to the seduction of the rash or reckless act, almost as if they had never considered the matter at all. No, Mishka, the Count admitted with some sensing of foreboding. I can't imagine. What did you do? Mishka ran a hand across his forehead. What is a man supposed to do when confronted with such madness? I struck the passage out. Then I walked from the room without a word. Upon hearing this denouement, the Count felt a great sense of relief. Were it not for the defeated appearance of his old friend, he might even have smiled, for one must admit that there was something genuinely comic about the circumstances. It could have been a tale from Gogol, with Shalimov playing the part of a well-fed privy councillor, impressed by his own rank. And the offending passage, hearing of its pending fate, could have climbed out a window and escaped down an alley, never to be heard from again. That is, until it reappeared 10 years later on the arm of a French countess, wearing a pince-nez and the Légion d'honneur. But the Count maintained a solemn expression. You were perfectly right, he consoled. It was just a matter of a few sentences, 50 words out of a few 100,000. The Count pointed out on the balance Mikhail had done so much to be proud of. An authoritative collection of Chekhov's letters was long overdue. It promised to inspire a whole new generation of scholars and students, readers and writers. And Shalimov, with his long nose and little eyes, the Count had always found him to be something of a ferret. And one mustn't let a ferret spoil one's sense of accomplishment or one's cause for celebration. Listen, my friend, the Count concluded with a smile. You arrived on the overnight train and missed your lunch. That's half the problem right there. Go back to your hotel, take a bath, have something to eat and a glass of wine. Get a good night's sleep. Then tomorrow night we shall meet at the Shilopin as planned. Raise a glass to Brother Anton and have a good laugh at the ferret's expense. In this manner, the Count attempted to comfort his old friend, buoy his spirits, and move him gently toward the door. At 11:40, the Count finally descended to the ground floor and knocked at Marina's. I'm sorry I'm late, he said in a whisper when the seamstress answered the door. Where's Sophia? I can carry her upstairs. There's no need to whisper, Alexander. She's awake. You kept her up? I didn't keep anybody anything, Marina retorted. She insisted upon waiting for you. The two went inside where Sophia was sitting on a chair with perfect posture. At the sight of the Count, she leapt to the floor, walked to his side, and took him by the hand. Marina raised an eyebrow, as if to say, You see? The Count raised his own eyebrows, as if to reply, Imagine that. Thank you for dinner, Aunt Marina, Sophia said to the seamstress. Thank you for coming, Sophia. Then Sophia looked up at the Count. Can we go now? Certainly, my dear. When they left Marina's, it was obvious enough to the Count that the little Sophia was ready for bed. Without letting go of his hand, she led him straight to the lobby, onto the elevator, and pressed the button for the fifth floor with the command of presto. When they reached the belfry, rather than asking to be carried, she practically dragged him up the last flight of stairs, and when he introduced her to the ingenious design of her new bunk bed, she barely took notice. Instead, she hurried down the hall to brush her teeth and get into her nightgown. But when she returned from the bathroom, instead of slipping under the covers, she climbed onto the desk chair. Aren't you ready for bed? The Count asked in surprise. Wait, she replied, putting up a hand to silence him. Then she leaned a little to her right in order to look around his torso. Mystified, the Count stepped aside and turned just in time to see the long-strided watchman of the 2 minutes catch up with his bow-legged brother of the hours. As the two embraced, the springs loosened, and the wheels spun, the miniature hammer of the twice-tolling clock began to signal the arrival of midnight. As Sophia listened, she sat perfectly still. Then, with the 12th and final chime, she leapt down from the chair and climbed into bed. "Good night, Uncle Alexander," she said, and before the Count could tuck her in, she had fallen fast asleep.
All right. I think we shall stop there. It's not in the middle. It is in the middle of a chapter, but it is a long chapter at that. So we will stop there, and I'll catch up with you next time. All right, hope you're enjoying this one. Bye.